Welcome to our Telecoms Takeaway. This is the first podcast in our new series talking about the changes to the Electronic Communications Code brought in by the ongoing implementation of the Product Security and Telecommunications Infrastructure Act 2022, or otherwise known as the PSTIA, which is a lot easier to say. And we'll be looking particularly at the potential impact this act has on code operators and landowners alike. In today's episode, we'll be looking at the background to the implementation of the PSTIA, why it was introduced, and the issues it was designed to address. This will act as an introduction to our four-part series, where we'll go on to look at the changes that have been implemented, those yet to be implemented, and the future developments in this area. So I'm a senior associate in our property disputes team. My name is Chris Dent, and I'm joined today by my colleague Tom Bumpstead, an associate director in the same team. We both specialise in code disputes and work for a number of operators. I'll start by asking Tom some questions, and then for our next episode, it'll be my turn in the hot seat.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us, Tom, and I'm really looking forward to kicking off our discussion on this topic. So to start us off, Tom, what is this all about? What is the PSTIA, and why was it introduced?
So thanks, Chris. I think the important point to make is that the PSTIA is made up of two parts. So we've got part one, which is titled Product Security, and that introduces a new cybersecurity regime and is outside the scope of what we're talking about in this series. So we're going to focus on part two, which is snappily titled Telecommunications Infrastructure. And primarily, this implements amendments to the Electronic Communications Code, but it does have a wider focus. So there are also changes to the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954 and changes to the Communications Act 2003, which signposts further regulations that might come in. So we'll go on to discuss the detail later in the series of all these changes. Just looking at the code then, I think it's fair to say that the code has had a rocky time since it was first introduced in December 2017. I think probably, again, fair to say that primarily this has been down to changes that were made to, or one of the major reasons is this down to changes that were made on the base about the basis on which code rights are valued. So under the code, there really is limited incentive for landowners to engage with operators to grant rights on a consensual basis due to a reduction in the money that was being paid compared to the pre-code regime. So because of that lack of incentive, that this has led to a high volume of litigation, and that's delayed the process of rolling out the infrastructure and the upgrades to the network that the government recognises is a national priority, really, to help improve coverage and access to fast and reliable mobile internet. Trying to tackle that issue, and in response, the government ran a consultation in January 2021 and listened to feedback from all sides before introducing the PSTIA in December 2022. And really, the main purpose of the PSTIA is to take in feedback from operators and landowners and then make a series of discrete and targeted tweaks and changes to tackle some of the particular problem areas. These include dealing with rights for operators to upgrade and share equipment, a new regime to deal with blocking the grant of code rights on the grounds of national security, changes to the process for renewing code rights, including renewals under the 54 Act, which we'll perhaps pick up later, and a new set of requirements obliging parties to engage in alternative dispute resolution. And finally, a new code of practice to drive better behaviour from operators and landowners, with a new duty on Ofcom to compel parties to comply. So a real range of different areas that have all been tweaked and amended slightly by the PSTIA.
Thanks for that, Tom. That's really insightful. So as you've said, there's kind of a bit of a grab bag of different changes the PSTIA has brought in. So looking at those, are there any concerns about these that weren't? Are there any concerns about things that weren't included?
Well, this being the code, there's bound to be controversy. So I'd say probably one of the biggest points that was missed out, going into this, people were looking for was providing a definition of the meaning of occupier, which might seem, or the term occupier within the code, which might seem quite a pedantic complaint, but is actually a fairly thorny issue that was central to one of the key decisions in this area, which was the Supreme Court's decision in the Compton-Bochum case. So just to provide some background on this one for the uninitiated, this case concerned an attempt by an operator, Cornerstone, to seek a renewal of code rights over a site that was occupied by Vodafone. So Cornerstone are what is known as an infrastructure provider, meaning that they act as a host or provide and basically provide a platform for other mobile network operators or MNOs. This being telecoms, we love our acronyms. So it provides them with a with MNOs with a platform to install apparatus such as antenna and dishes, which actually do the job of broadcasting the network that we connect to on our phones. So you can connect to the Vodafone network, you can't connect to the Cornerstone network. So looking at that, Cornerstone, effectively the way it works, the Cornerstone manage a number of sites within Vodafone's network, and where agreements fall due for renewal, the general approach by between MNOs and infrastructure providers is that the infrastructure provider, so here Cornerstone, would renew the actual underlying site agreement, and then Vodafone come and put their stuff on the site. So the problem with that is that the code is structured such that code rights can only be granted by the occupier of the land, hence the importance of defining that term. Thompson Beauchamp case confirmed that under the code as currently drafted, in this situation, where there's a sitting operator, i.e. Vodafone, that operator will be the occupier for the purpose of the code, which was a helpful decision because, this is occupier, like I say, is a very important term, the only one who can grant code rights, but the term actually isn't defined within the code. So, albeit that was a helpful clarification, it created a problem for infrastructure providers like Cornerstone, as it means that it is necessary to go through a slightly artificial process when these sites come up for renewal. So instead of just Cornerstone being able to renew as the party that will run the site and have the relationship going forward, it's actually the sitting operator, so Vodafone, has to renew in their name and then look to assign the site to the infrastructure provider. So this slightly torturous process from an operator's point of view, seems slightly artificial, and it's difficult to believe this could have been the intended result at the outset when the code was introduced, as it brings in a degree of complexity that could have been avoided if we had a clear, code-based definition of occupier. It could just be, a single line within the code that provides that definition. And that was something that parties were looking or hoping might be introduced as part of the PSTIA. And there actually was a draft clause dealing with this point and providing a definition at one stage, but it was removed after the Compton-Beauchamp decision on the perhaps optimistic basis that case has now resolved the question. But I think, certainly from an operator point of view, there are still some outstanding questions, and we're still left with a slightly clunky process that perhaps could have been tweaked further.
Okay, great. So it seems like rather than defining it in the legislation and getting clarity on that altogether, they've just left it to case law, and hoping that won't be overturned. So other than that missed opportunity, do you think there are other missed opportunities that the PSTIA has failed to implement or change?
I think that, again, it depends on your perspective, and obviously we'll get into the detail of the changes later in the series. I think it's fair to say that a general theme is that the changes that have been brought in aim to strike a balance, which is obviously a laudable aim, but it has meant that some of the changes are relatively minor in scope. I think a good example of that is the changes brought in relating to automatic rights to upgrade and share in respect of an existing site. So here you have something that looks pretty significant on first glance. Bills itself as, it's going to provide for automatic rights to upgrade and share apparatus, which is exactly the kind of thing operators were crying out for, because it would allow them to crack on with making maximum use of the vast number of sites that they occupy under older pre-code agreements, which obviously still form the bulk of operators' portfolios. But really, the devil is in the detail with this change brought in by the PSTIA, as the wording makes it clear that this change only applies where apparatus is installed underland. It means that this retrospective change, importing these automatic upgrade and sharing rights, would only really apply to fiber installations and doesn't do anything to shift the dial for rooftop and greenfield sites used by MNOs. for the purposes of our, you know, mobile phone usage. Also important to note that the change only applies to agreements relating to apparatus installed before December 2003, so under the old licensing regime, and won't cover apparatus installed after that date under pre-code agreements, known as subsisting agreements, which really form the, you know, the bulk of the older sites that operators are looking to, you know, to renew or to do new things with. So, you know, obviously the code came into force in December 2017. So there's still a very large number of these pre-code agreements in place. Another restraint is that these automatic rights to upgrade and share are capped by reference to stringent conditions, which require that any change must have no adverse effect on the landlord's enjoyment of the land and must not cause any loss or damage to the landowner. These are, you know, these are conditions that are aligned with paragraph 17 of the code, which sets out a bare minimum of upgrade and sharing rights, which any new code agreement has to contain. MNOs and mobile infrastructure providers regularly seek rights above that minimum, you know, on the basis that that minimum floor is not sufficient to allow them to make maximum and effective use of their sites. So taken together, it means that, you know, looking at this change, where you have something that at first glance appears to be significant and something that could have had a major impact on enabling rollout will actually have, you know, is actually extremely limited. Of course, the reasons for taking this approach are understandable. Landowners would rightly complain that it would be unfair and prejudicial to introduce swinging and retrospective changes to your contractual arrangements, which might have an adverse impact on them. But another solution might have been to apply the changes to all installations, both fibre and MNO, installed under all subsisting agreements, but to keep that condition limiting rights in accordance with Paragraph 17. Of course, that wouldn't be exactly what operators were looking for, but it would still have meant that operators could make changes that wouldn't have an adverse impact and allowed for limited upgrades to be carried out. As it is, the position remains for MNOs that they'll either need to seek an expensive and time-consuming renewal where they want to carry out upgrades outside their current rights or make further payments to secure those rights. So in making the change, the Act has really just tinkered around the edge, trying to make everyone happy, but potentially missing the opportunity to break what is currently a deadlock in rollout of apparatus and so speed that up.
Thanks for that, Tom. Again, that's a really helpful explanation of where the PSTIA has failed to deal with missed opportunities. So apart from the missed opportunities of the PSTIA, are there any examples of clear wins, particularly where maybe the PSTIA has brought in real clarity rather than just tinkering around the edges?
Well, I think one good example, you know, a good news story in relation to the PSTIA is the change that's brought in to the 54 Act. So where MNOs and infrastructure providers occupy rooftop or greenfield sites under 1954 Act protected leases, those fall to be renewed under the 54 Act rather than under the code. This renewal process then, if you like, spits out a code agreement, which in due course is then renewed under the code. So it's a slightly torturous process that has led to real difficulties because the 54 Act process differs in key respects from the renewal process under the code. Again, money is the key point here. So, you know, a particular difference is the different mechanism for assessing what the rent should be under the new agreement under the 54 Act compared with assessing payments due under a code renewal. So that can lead to a situation where if you were looking to renew two identical sites, one occupied under the 54 Act and the other occupied under a code agreement, you know, you could end up with different payments, which is obviously a slightly peculiar outcome. So this discrepancy has been addressed by the PSTIA and it aligns valuations under these two regimes. And this strikes me as a sensible and controversial change, particularly as it's often a matter of historical accident. The older agreements were protected by the 54 Act, you know, as a result of them, of, you know, quite a few of the older agreements are fairly informal. And so, you know, the parties may have, you know, simply not bothered to contract them out of the 54 Act. So hence they are 54 Act protected agreements. And so I think this change is particularly helpful given the guidance offered by the tribunal, you know, particularly in the Affinity Water case, which again, by way of background, provided a effectively a rating table, which set out typical values for different site types and set out an approximate level of rent for those site types. So you could just read into the table, is it a rooftop site, is it a greenfield site, etc. Here's roughly what the payment should be. And that's helped to, that table in relation to co-disputes has really helped to minimize the scope for dispute, where valuation used to be a real, a real contentious topic. So by applying that same process, that same valuation approach that's worked well for code renewals to the 54 Act, that should really reduce scope in what, what can be a contentious area. And obviously, it achieves the objective of aligning outcomes for these two different, for 54 Act and code agreements, which again seems to be a very sensible outcome. It's worth flagging, though, that these changes to the 54 Act introduced by the PSTIA haven't yet been implemented, but I think there'll be a welcome change when they come in.
Brilliant. Thanks for that, Tom. And I think that really gives us some good background and an introduction to frame the next part of the next episodes in our series as we go on to look at the PSTIA in detail. So summing up the key takeaways from today's episode, we've talked about how the changes to the code brought in by the PSTIA aim to strike a balance between the needs of operators and landowners, picked out particular problem areas that we'll go on to focus on in our follow-up episodes, and the desire to strike a balance and how the desire to strike a balance between landowners and operators has meant that more decisive changes have been avoided. And potentially this is a missed opportunity, but it has avoided upsetting the apple cart. And there we have it. If you're interested in discussing any of these issues in this podcast further, please do get in touch. On that note, thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you again next week for part two, where we'll be looking at the key changes that have been implemented to date.